Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Condicious.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Flavour, in which, as usual, we will be bringing you the local food and drink stories from Cambridge and the surrounding areas. Sue Bailey is away this week, but Alan Alder and myself, Matt Bentman, we're here as usual, and here's Alan with details of some of today's features.
Yes, we're deep into autumn with Christmas rapidly approaching, so today we have some autumnal recipe ideas from our resident chef, Rosie Sykes.
I've also done that squash dish with the brown butter, just as roast squash. And then brown butter and ricotta. Gosh, it's really easy to do and really delicious.
Sue Bailey has been out foraging in and around Grantchester Meadows with Steve Thompson of the Green Man in Grantchester.
Absolutely wonderful. You can pick it in the spring, you can pick it in the autumn. This time of the year for picking it is about my favourite. I think you get the best flavour. You're looking at a really lovely, nutty, kind of almost fresh pea flavour to it.
We have a preview of the Feast and Fast exhibition, which starts at the Fitzwilliam Museum on Tuesday.
You see the Chinese crack porcelain plates? Well, they're made of sugar. You know, what you do is you eat them at the end of the meal to save the
eat
washing
the
up. So it's
exactly
a big joke. So it's kind of almost like kiddies' humour.
We hear from Isabelle Chapelle, founder of Chocolat Chocolat in St Andrew Street, about some of their Christmas specials.
The most popular is our Christmas cake flavour on milk chocolate, which I'll make only 6 weeks before because it has 7 ingredients on it.
And we've also news about Christmas specials from Meadows in Eltersley Avenue and a visit to a new Italian cafe, Modigliani, run by two brothers.
We are two young guys from Italy, came in UK with nothing, and we are here making our dream. Cambridge gave us a big, big hug.
And we hear from Alex Rushmer and Lawrence Butler of Vanderlyle in Mill Road. They'll have a stall at the Mill Road Winter Fair and will be telling us what they'll be serving from it.
You can contact us by texting 07919 070490, or you can email us anytime on flavour@cambridge105.co.uk or send us a tweet at flavour105.
Let's begin with a trip to Grantchester Meadows, where Sue Bailey meets the foraging chef Steve Thompson from the Green Man in Grantchester on a cold November day.
Hi, Steve.
Hi, Sue. Yeah, it's a little bit brisk out here, isn't it?
It is a bit.
Lovely and crisp.
So we're at the end of November, and what do you recommend on the foraging front now?
We're going to talk about winter wild vegetables. So the first one at this time of year, which doesn't often get a mention, but really should do because it's absolutely fantastic, is chickweed. And it's another one that in the past we have cultivated heavily for vegetables, and it's just kind of grown out and it's used a lot more as ground cover now. Things like absolutely wonderful. You can pick it in the spring, you can pick it in the autumn. This time of the year for picking it is about my favourite. I think you get the best flavour. You're looking at a really lovely, nutty, kind of almost fresh pea flavour to it.
Historically, was it used in dishes?
Yes. I think people like the Romans and stuff used to use it. It's a lot like things like the Alexanders and the wild fennel and stuff. I don't know actually if chickweed was brought over by them, but a lot of plants were brought over by them, which is why you see them on the edge of the old Roman roads and things like that. Now, chickweed is much more commonly used now as ground cover. It grows rapidly. Lots of people, it's the bane of the gardener's life, getting out your back garden. But instead of chucking it all in your green bin, lovely in a salad. Pestos, whack it through some pasta. It holds up to cooking as well. It is really good. You can treat it like a spinach in that sense. So raw, cooked, it's one of our absolute favourites.
And we tried to hunter some of it just now, but I think the cows in Grantchester Meadows got there first.
The cows have just grazed a little, yes. So we'll be going down to the next field later to go get our harvest ready for the menu. But the other wonderful things that they have left behind is we've got the shoots coming back through again for their second go. So things that you'd normally pick in the spring are now coming through again for their second go. So you've got hogweed coming through again. Shoots not quite as delicate as they are in the spring. Again, cooking them, that gets away. Just pick it, find it soft. If it feels woody, it'll probably be woody. So use your instincts with that. Things like the cow parsley is coming back through again, or wild chervil. That is absolutely fantastic, but not a beginner's one to forage.
Wild chervil.
Yeah, wild chervil. In the early spring, it's a lot easier to forage because the nasties aren't normally about, but you can never rely on nature to be 100%, so you always check it. This time of year, the nasties shouldn't be about either.
What are the nasties?
Well, your classic one is your hemlock, isn't it? Yeah, you're looking at the moment, it's It's ground cover level, so you're not getting the big cow parsley coming up, but you're getting the shoots. And what I always look for is taking the stem off the main stem, so it's going to the leaves, and you're looking for a V-shape, and you're looking for hairs.
This is for cow parsley?
For cow parsley, yes, certainly.
What about the giant hogweed?
Giant hogweed, I have never, ever seen around Grantchester. Giant hogweed is completely different to common hogweed. It is, in all essence, it's something that people are very scared of, but it is what it says. It is giant. You're looking at big, thick stems. It's just very different. Telltale spots with a lot of the umbilifer families, which is the family that have the... At the top, you've got the classic flower bud that everyone knows as cow parsley, where all of the stems of the flower bud come from one spot on the main stem. And that pretty much tells you it's an umbilifer. So you've got your wild carrots and things like that, and your hogweed, your hemlocks. There's absolutely loads of them. There's some really good eaters. But as I say, there is some nasties. Yeah, giant hogweed is just enormous. And you're not going to find it this time of year, so you're okay with that.
But the one that you can find is hogweed.
Yeah, the common hogweed is reshooting again at the moment. And that's lovely. A lot of people compare it to asparagus. I think, in all honesty, I prefer it to asparagus in the spring. This time of the year, it can be a bit woody, but it's also, you can get the flavour out of it in other ways. So we extract the flavour into oils. We ferment it. Things that will break down the cell walls a bit more and kind of help keep it nice and supple.
And what does the stem of that one look like?
It's very different. You're looking at the leaves on that one. The leaves are much bigger than, say, a cow parsley and that kind of thing. And they're nice and jagged. With the difference between, say, the leaves look quite similar on the common and the giant, except for, like, the giant is just much more accented on everything. So your leaves are looking sharper, like you've got almost little razor edges coming off it and everything like that. But if you find giant hogweed at this time of year, it's gone to seed, it's gone. Whereas I've never seen it have another shoot again at this time of year. Common hogweed is just, it's all over the woods down in Grantchester, and it's a lovely one, really nice. And with the second shoot has also brought the seeds. So we're doing another harvest on the seeds at the moment, which are absolutely great. Almost like tangerine peel. So you take your seeds, you dry them out, and you can use them. We use them to flavour gins and sell them behind the bar, and it gives it a lovely hint of orangeness to it, and it's really nice. You've got the bitterness as well. A lot of people compare it to cardamom and things like that as well.
Ooh, I love cardamom. So what about things that we can't necessarily find in the meadows but you would recommend hunting for elsewhere?
So a good thing at the moment... So let's go on to the mushrooms again, because as I say, the main crop has come into the end. You'll still find some winter chanterelles, but you're not going to find them in Cambridgeshire. And if you are, please let me know. So we've been looking a lot at tree funguses. And the one that we've been finding a lot at the moment is grows mainly on oak, but you can also find it on sweet chestnut. And it's the beefsteak fungus. It's been popularised by the famous restaurant Noma in Copenhagen. It's absolutely wonderful alternative to meat. It gets its name because when you cut into it, it has the marbling like a really good bit of steak has. You squeeze it and the liquid comes out of it, so it does look like it bleeds and everything. Worth saying, it's one of the few mushrooms that you can forage that you can eat straight away, raw. This doesn't need any cooking, and I, in fact, would discourage cooking it. I think it's much better without the cooking. It's got quite a watery flavour to it, so as you have it straight away, it's like kind of watery oxalic acid. So I think something a bit like light rhubarb, kind of wood sorrelly flavours. What we do with the beefsteak fungus is we make a Douglas fir salt. So we take the Douglas fir pine needles, we dehydrate them, make them into a powder. We then mix this with a crystal salt. So something like Malden is absolutely perfect for that. And we add a couple of spoonfuls of water. We then whack that back in the dehydrator. You're not looking to break the crystals up at all. Keep them nice and whole. And then that little amount of water will be absorbed. So then after that, we leave it for a couple of hours. Then we mix it up. You want to keep it moving there once an hour until it's completely dry. And then you'll get a lovely, vivid, bright green salt that has the lovely kind of citrusy, earthy flavours of the Douglas fir.
I've never heard of the flavoured salts like that. That sounds incredible.
Yeah, we do it with a lot. It's a good way of preserving things. So if you've got too much, your dehydrate is your friend. And you start to learn after a while, there's certain things that don't dehydrate well and certain things that do. And it's just trial and error is great with anything wild.
So the beefsteak mushroom dehydrates very well once, as you say, it's had the Douglas salt with it.
Dehydrate it, we actually compress it. So that's putting it in a vacuum bag,
right,
in a vacuum machine. And when you put something under pressure, it obviously helps to break the cell walls a bit. The salt also breaks it down, so it draws out a lot of the moisture out of the mushroom. So you have a slightly drier mushroom, but it's still very much pliable. It's not dried out at all, but it's intensified the flavour. It's taken away that watery quality that I don't like from them. and it's kept the oxalic acidy flavour to it, which is what we're looking for.
So you put a proportion of the salt in with the mushroom?
In the vacuum seal, yes. And that helps everything together. With the vacuum seal and the salt, it helps draw everything out.
Vacuum sealer is not a particularly chefy thing. I mean, this is the sort of thing that anyone can buy and use.
Yeah, they've become a lot more at home, and they're a great thing to have to help, well, help preserve. It's a good way of keeping things bacteria-free, exactly. As long as you're clean in the first place.
True. Anything else that you would recommend?
So at the moment as well, the other thing that's coming through still is the nettles again. They're coming back, but they come around all year. So we will be making a nice little crop. I find at this time of year, they get a little bit more bitter. So you've got a much more astringent flavour to them as well. But they're another great one at the moment. We're just coming to the tail end of the mushrooms, as I say, but you'll still probably find some bluets around here. Field bluets are one of my absolute favourites, Lepista salva. They're absolutely wonderful. And blue legs is their common name. And they're a good beginner mushroom. You're looking for the blue leg. Again, a Roger Phillips mushroom guide. A Phil Blewett is a safe one for people to go out and have a look for. And it is a really good eater. Cooked up with a little bit of sherry, a little bit of cream, on toast. Can't beat
Sounds
it.
Really nice. Oh, I think I hear the cows coming over.
They're coming back for the chickweed.
They are indeed. Thank you very much indeed. I think that's our very interesting guide to what is available in November, considering that people might look around and think leaves are falling off the trees, there's not going to be much around. But actually, if you know what you're looking for, there is.
There is still stuff around. Yep. December, January is notorious for there not being as much, but we will be talking about roots next month. And that is the one to go for.
Looking forward to it. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thanks, Sue. Cheers.
Yeah, well, that should be good. I remember as a teenager foraging dandelion roots to make dandelion root coffee.
Was it any good?
Well, I was expecting it to taste like coffee, you know, sort of the naivety of a teenage boy. And it didn't, so I was disappointed. And I can't remember what it was like, but really, I ought to try again, oughtn't I? Mm. And report to an agog Cambridge audience. And here's news of free food available now Saturday in and around Cambridge. This can be found on the free-to-download Olio app. If you're listening to a repeat or to the podcast, check the Olio app for what's currently available.
OK, and looking at the Olio app, we find that Gail, near Impington, she has a collection of red apples and a collection of pears separately to give away. You'll just need to contact her via the Olio app to arrange pickup. Andrea, who's over on the River Cam towards Fen Ditton Way, has a bottle of Aptamil 0 to 6 months infant milk available today from 6 p.m. I should say. And finally, Ruth has a jar of elderflower and rose curd and a bottle of sweet ginger sauce. Now, she's based near the junction where the A505 crosses the A10. She can leave it outside for you to collect. This stuff is too sweet for us, she says. And that's just a few of the items that are being given away right now for free on the Olio app in and around Cambridgeshire.
Yes, they sound rather good, don't they?
Yeah.
And remember that a source of heavily reduced, but not free, food is the Too Good To Go app, which some food outlets in and around Cambridge use to sell off any remaining goods they have shortly before they close for the day, and that's free to download as well.
Yeah, great service. So now let's move on with some ideas for autumn produce, and this time it's squash. Here's Rosie Sykes.
You know, there are so many varieties of squash and there are some really wonderful ones. I've been doing loads of things. One of my favourite things I've been doing at the moment is a Persian squash and yellow split pea sort of, well, it's a koresh, which they say is a bit like their version of curry. So you normally eat it with rice, but it's not hugely spiced. It's got cinnamon and turmeric in it and it's really lovely. Sweated down onions with these spices and then yellow split peas cooked in some vegetable stock. They do it often with some meat as well, but I wanted to do it, in fact, vegan. And the real stunner about it is that at the end you add some yellow sour plums. But if you can't get those, if you just put a few dried apricots in, gosh, it's absolutely delicious. Really delicious. And then last weekend, I made a pumpkin gnocchi, which I've always been a little bit scared of making gnocchi, but this turned out really well. It was really, really easy, lovely recipe. So it was about 50% squash, 70, 30 squash to potato,
What, by weight or volume? Or I suppose it's much the same.
By weight, yeah. Okay. Just bake them both in the oven, then put them through a potato ricer if you have one. Add some flour, and if it, unless it's super wet, a bit of egg, some nutmeg. That was it, really. And then give it a rest, roll it into long sausages, cut it into pieces, cook it in some hot water. And then I made a lovely brown butter. So just cook the butter really, really slowly until all the solids go to the bottom and start to caramelize and go really lovely and brown. And I throw in a big handful of sage, let that carry on cooking. When the butter's lovely and brown, you sort of shock it with some lemon juice to stop it cooking, some chili and a tiny bit of crushed garlic. And that with the squash gnocchi was lovely.
What made you think of it? Or think of doing it?
What, the gnocchi?
Yeah.
So, in fact, it came from Joseph Trevelli, who's the executive chef at the River Cafe, or head chef, I'm not quite sure which he calls himself, actually. But he brought a book out last spring, and that was one of the recipes in there, was for squash gnocchi. And he did his with chicken livers, actually, which someone has done for me, and it was absolutely delicious. I've also done that squash dish with the brown butter, just as roast squash, and then brown butter and ricotta. Gosh, it's really easy to do and really delicious.
Mm. They sound good. Squash gnocchi. Actually, there's a recipe in today's Feast magazine that comes with Saturday's Guardian for parsnip gnocchi.
Oh, yeah.
But I really fancy the first one that Rosie spoke about, which was that Persian curry. And we may very well be having a feature on Persian food early in the new year, so something to look forward to. And Rosie will be back on the next edition of Flavour with alternatives to Christmas pudding.
Now, two brothers from Calabria in northern Italy have set up shop in Mill Road. It's a coffee shop and a focacceria. Now, as a region, they say that Calabria has many influences food-wise, from Piemonte, Sicily, Puglia, many regions, in fact. And in a similar way, it was a mixture of cultures that attracted them to Cambridge, somewhere where they felt that they would feel at home.
Apparently, in Cambridge, not many business do stuff like us, from zero. Mm. We try to do not that many things. Obviously, we are a coffee shop and focacceria. We don't have that much, but what we do, we try to do it at our best.
Voglio cannelloni per me, sì, per me.
This is Anthony Decimano, and together with his brother Kevin, they have set up Modigliani, a focacceria on Mill Road. They're Italian, they're effortlessly stylish, they put the art in artisan.
I think both me and my brother, we have this kind of love for arts, and inside of us we always wanted to be like an artist. He's a chef. He really starts to cook from the brain, from the mind, from the heart, from the soul.
Is this your first business, working with your brother?
Yes, it is indeed. Me as a manager, I start obviously as a barista, I did a little bit of everything. And another one of my dreams was to travel. 4 years and a half, I was working 8 months a year, traveling the other 4 months, Budapest, Barcelona, London. It gave me the chance to learn something from other culture.
Yeah.
From the side of my brother instead, he started to work when he was really young in a kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
He was really passionate. His big dreams was always to be a chef, to run a business.
Uh-huh.
Two years ago, we had a phone call to each other, talking about a little bit of everything. What would you like to do in your life? And we were talking, and he said, you know what, I really would like to run my business. And you? And in my mind, I was like, you know what, the same for me, because this is one of my big goals. Why would we not do something together? We try at least.
Yeah.
We share our skills, energy, big energy, me and him, together, and we start to open our business. We start with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Zero. It was just me and him with an idea in the mind. That's it. And from this time till now, we never stopped.
And it's a wonderful location too. We're here at 54A Mill Road.
Yeah.
The huge amount of response you've had,
yeah,
both on Instagram,
yeah,
and on Twitter. People,
yeah,
making
I'm
such
so
wonderful
for
comments.
That. Yeah. It's a blessing for us. This is the reason, because we wake up every day really early. We go to sleep really late. 7 or 7, no stop. Yeah.
Dopo moscardini per me, sì per me.
Anthony loves art and literature. He wanted to be a filmmaker, a screenwriter. He's written a book on poetry and directed two short movies in Bologna. This love of the arts permeates the business.
Yeah, there is a lot of inspirations from these big artists. Indeed, our name is Modigliani, the name of the shop.
And the Modigliani logo is Botticelli's Venus, which is also on the wall in the Focacceria.
And the logo, it's a bit of Venus because the first time when I came in Florence, I went to the Uffizi and I saw this beautiful paint and I was like shocked and say, this is the beauty for me.
And then translate that beauty into food.
Mortadella from Bologna,
yep.
Pancetta from Trieste, oregano directly from Calabria.
Yep.
If anyone's ever smelt true hand-picked oregano from these places, I have a friend, a Greek friend, who once gave me a jar of hand-picked oregano from her parents' field in Greece. I treasured that because the smell was leagues above oregano that you may find in a store here. It's those sort of things that are so vitally important. It's those sort of things, as you said, that make your customers react. You're going to great lengths to bring all these foods here, and you show them off as well with such stunning photography.
Like I said, one focaccia is not just a focaccia. It's everything start from the origin. So 95% of the ingredients you use in the shop is from Italy. For example, like you say, our mortadella, we say, okay, let's do something with the mortadella, which we love with mortadella, but has to be from Bologna, because the most delicious mortadella is from Bologna. There is a big, big culture about mortadella. So we say, if you need to do something with the mortadella, it has to be from Bologna. Same, for example, with our Da Vinci focaccia. The Da Vinci, it's a San Marzano sauce from San Marzano, which are really, really good, and fresh basil, cherry tomato, and burrata from Puglia. We take the burrata from Puglia because we say, okay, we want the burrata. Where you can find the best burrata in Italy? Puglia. The pancetta is from Trieste. Our giotto, really popular focaccia, is made with pancetta from Trieste because it's amazing. And with friarelli, which are marinated broccoli from Naples.
Yes.
Because we say, okay, I think it could be amazing to put these two things together. So Trieste, North Italy, Naples, but the best from Trieste, the best from Naples, friarelli, where you can find the real friarelli. Our focaccias or coffees, cakes have name of Botticelli, Da Vinci, Michelangelo. It's all, we try to take inspiration from them daily.
You mentioned la burrata.
It's kind of mozzarella. The process is more longer. The burrata itself is similar to the mozzarella, but inside is more fluffy, like milky. The taste is amazing. And in this case, our burrata is really artisan, so it's from Puglia specifically, so it's... I'm so in love. Sometimes you can even just sit a little bit of burrata, a little bit of extra virgin olive oil, a little bit of salt, and you're in heaven. It's so good.
There is a video, I presume it's your brother, where he has a burrata.
And we open the burrata, yeah.
He slices it down very nice and slowly, parts it and squeezes it, and you see that fluffiness.
Exactly. Yeah, you explained really well. So you have to see to try.
Yes, you do, you do.
Because to explain it's really hard.
Yeah.
But you see, when you open the burrata, it's just, wow. It's like, you know, you don't need to put that much ingredients in something. You need 2-3, but... Yeah. That match together, they're amazing, and it's good.
Yeah. Io mi aspettavo, sai da te.
It's not just about money, it's about leave something to the others. Like, we like to say Mediterranean soul food. We believe, you know, if you really touch someone in the deep, it could be with a nice word, with a nice coffee, a good coffee, could be a good focaccia, it's priceless. Definitely, me and my brother, we are on the same page on this point, 100%. Also, there is a lot of competition in Cambridge. There are plenty of coffee shops. Just in Miroda, there are almost endless coffee shops. You know what? If you need to be like the others, we will never win, because the only way is really to put our soul, tell a story, our coffee, food, us as a person. And this is really important. You see people that maybe they're not from Mirror, they came from out of Cambridge, just to try one of our coffee, one of our focaccia, or one canola, or one biscuit. I'm like, wow. And I'm saying that in a really humble way. I'm just like, wow, beautiful.
Yeah.
The only way is to tell a story. In this case, I always say to my brother, you know, I think we do one of the best job in the world because we try to bring some joy, even just for a moment, to people. So you know what? It could be worse.
Passion always makes the difference.
Always. Do what you love.
Well, thanks very much, Anthony. We are here at Modigliani on 54A Mill Road. You're open from 7 a.m. till 6:30 p.m. most days.
Yes. Monday to Friday, and I'll pass 8, 6 Saturday, and 10, 5 on Sunday.
And I'm sure that in your head, you never switch off.
Yeah, never, never. Lifestyle.
Really nice place. They also do vegan sandwiches, by the way, including focaccias and pastries and gluten-free cakes too. And there is a 15% discount for students. So that's Modigliani. You can find them on Instagram at modigliani.cambridge. Now, in 2 weeks' time, on Saturday the 7th of December, it's the Mill Road Winter Fair. Cambridge 105 Radio will be broadcasting live, so there will be no Flavour that day. However, that will give the Flavour team a chance to enjoy plenty of local foods, and a store that will interest a lot of people is the one that Van der Lyle is setting up. So here are Alex Rushmer and Lawrence Butler.
Can you tell me what you're doing at the Winter Fair?
We will be bringing back the rubbish cooks. In aid of winter comfort.
You know, there might be people who don't know what Rubbish Cooks is.
Look, Rubbish Cooks is, I'd like to say, a global movement, but at the moment it's quite a local movement, and using what would otherwise go in the bin and doing something delicious with it. So this year we'll be making soup and very, very, very fresh focaccia bread.
And this is actually on Mill Road itself, not in the restaurant.
Yes, absolutely. So we will hopefully have a little table set up outside where we will be we'll be selling our wares in aid of charity.
And so the stall's going to be in front of Van der Lyle.
The stall will be in front of Van der Lyle. It's a great opportunity for people to come and talk to us, for us to introduce ourselves to people that haven't necessarily seen the restaurant or been into the restaurant as well. We can talk about our philosophy, we can talk about what we're doing, as well as raising heaps of cash for charity.
Right. Do you think you're going to have time for talking? Because actually it strikes me you're going to have immense queues.
Honestly, we have no idea. I think is the honest truth.
We have no idea how much soup to make, so we'll just make litres and litres of it and lots of bread and see what happens. But, you know, for I think we said we're going to go for £3. For £3 for a mug of soup and some fresh bread, all in aid of a good cause, we expect to see, or we really hope to see, hundreds and hundreds of people here at Van der Lyle.
Well, I think you will. And what time are you starting?
I think we'll start about 11:30.
Yes, that's about right to say that.
We'll allow people to have a cup of coffee first and sort of wander up and down, and then we'll get our pitch ready in time for lunch.
And you will be serving until the soup runs dry, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Fingers crossed it won't run dry too soon. So yeah.
Okay, that sounds like a great idea. And Tristan Welch from Parker's Tavern, is he involved? Because he's keen on
Rubbish
Cooks, isn't he?
Is something that we came up with alongside Tristan almost 2 years ago now. Tristan does monthly events at Parker's Tavern. We thought it was about time that we introduced the Rubbish Cooks here at Van der Lyle, and I think he might be persuaded to put in a guest appearance at some point. So if you want to see the three of us cooking together, then make sure you're here on the Winter Fair.
Great stuff. Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, that's unmissable, isn't it? You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. And there's a major exhibition opening at the Fitzwilliam Museum on Tuesday. It's called Feast and Fast. It looks back to the past, obviously, but is also of contemporary relevance, covering issues like food security and overconsumption in times of austerity. And there's also a collection of historical cookery books. The exhibition has some elaborate table settings to look at, and that includes a Jacobean sugar banquet created by food historian Ivan Day. And here, Sue Bailey gets a preview.
I was invited by Dr. Victoria Avery, who is the keeper of applied arts at the Fitz, to accompany her and Ivan as they oversaw the setting up of the exhibition a week or so ago. Ivan and Vicky first talk about a tablescape of a sugar wedding banquet of about 1600, with pastries, wafers and waffles, and a sugar paste representation of Melford Hall, Long Melford, the sugar paste bacon and eggs, gloves and sugar sweetmeat confetti.
So this is basically a Renaissance, an English Renaissance banquet of sweetmeats. Mm. Start really regarding the wonderful tablecloth. Mm. And this is based on a number of different things. One of them is a book by a man called Jervis Mark. And of course, it's the banquet in the meaning of the sweet apples, often served in a banqueting house. We've made one, which is based on one in Melford Hall. The tatsa, the sugar stands, are made out of sugar. The dolphins. So I try to make it using the... There's a lute player in the middle, and then there's a gingerbread man with a harp. These are bride knives. So they've given us another little dimension, which is... This is not just any old sugar banquet, it's after a wedding feast.
So I think the public come in and see this buffet on display, but then they also understand the context in which it would have occasionally been used.
Emulation, really, of a dining area.
This is all university
glass. That's the
Corpus Christi and Gondolin Keys.
That's the Keys tankard. So what Vicky's done, and Melissa, is they've reunited that with the rest of the... The period,
yes. Yeah.
We've got some very nice college lanes, actually. These wooden platters that basically decorated on one side. We've also shown the plain side. So you would use the plain side to support the food, and then at the end of the meal, you'd flip your plate over, and they're decorated with poems, mottos, the Christmas crackers, or, you know, that sort of festive thing at the end, or songs you could all sing together.
There were little joke things, like playing cards, which are made of sugar. You see the Chinese crack... porcelain plates.
Yes, yes.
Well, they're made of sugar. You know, what you do is you eat them at the end of the meal to save the washing up. So it's
exactly.
A joke. So it's kind of almost like kiddie's humour. These are sugar gloves. Now, what will happen is that sugar gloves are listed by one of the early food writers, a man called John Murrell. He talks about, for instance, marchpane or marzipan bacon and eggs as well. These are kind of fake. They're not real egg. They're sweets, you see. Everything's sweet.
It's a joke.
It's a joke, yeah. And then, but the main thing is the confetti, which obviously is related where people throw bits of paper over the bride's head. But of course, in the Renaissance, all over Europe, confetti was used at every single rite of passage. Sweetmeats, which were little bits of flecks of aniseed or cardamom or bits of cinnamon covered in sugar. So some of these tatsa have got these comfits, they were called. So that's, again, related to the wedding. And a lot of the other things have either been made, like the gingerbread men have actually been made from contemporary moulds. And we've got one or two of them on display. So see the little pikeman? We've got the mould that he's made out of in his display case.
On the other side, yes.
Every guest as a wedding favour were given a pair of white kid gloves that was scented, perfumed. And so the idea is that one of the wedding guests who just got up in a hurry to abandon the napkin and abandoned the party favours, but these white gloves, so again, you can eat the gloves.
Everything.
So some things you expect to be sweet, like the jumbles, like the biscuits, like the confetti, fine. Then you go, oh, well, maybe I will eat the bacon and eggs, but they end up not being savoury, they end up being sweet.
So it's all a ho-ho-ho.
It's a play.
Certain things you can't eat, because if you start eating the trencher, you'll know that actually that's wood.
This whole genre of it was called the banquet in England. It had other names in other European countries, but it became a very English phenomenon during the 16th and most of the 17th century. But the two objects which are really great here are the two knives, which are bride knives, because a bride was often given as a gift of a pair of knives by her husband. They basically seem to have been a symbol of fidelity, like your wedding ring. So she ate with that knife, or those knives, for the rest of her life. Well, these are things we've just totally forgotten about.
Yes.
So the stories are really... they're extraordinary. See, just there is a march pane.
Come and stand up and hear.
Oh, can I? Thank you.
You know, it's a white heart. That's actually made from a 16th century mould. You know, you can see more clearly things like, you know, these long comfits, which you also see in those paintings, you know.
The sugar gravel, the edible gravel,
spent
hours. So this is wonderful knot garden, as it were, the jams and jellies.
It's a fruit paste. These are kissing comfits, which were flavoured with perfumes. So they sweetened your breath. And all the wafers are made in 16th century wafering iron. But they've actually got designs impressed on them.
So what were the wafers have been made of?
Well, they're usually made from a mixture of cream, sugar and some flour. Yeah, and usually rose water. You bake a batter, and then you put the wafer over some hot charcoal, usually. Sometimes for a good fire, if it's not burning smoky. And then you put a little blob of it. You wax it with some beeswax, you shut them and you get this amazing whistling noise as it expands and
steams.
And it whistles. But it tells a very big story. It's
got this very sort of nice East Anglian link because of, you know,
Melford Hall.
So, and A, it's really, really beautiful. And some things are, well, you know, people will eventually get the kind of familiarity is a nice way to start the story. Then actually, it's not familiar because you've got all this kind of, in its high end bling.
It's forgotten stuff. The great thing is, you know, a lot of the objects that you get, people have forgotten how they were used as well.
We then go on to look at the preparations for an English 18th century confectioner's shop window called the Pot and Pineapple, with sugarwork, cakes and moulds and all the tools necessary to produce this amazing sugarwork and sugar flowers. And the famous Fitzwilliam pineapple is shown in the paintings and, in fact, in an ice cream mould that they've got on display.
So what we tried to do is to show that confectioners not only sold confectionery and things like these elaborate cakes, which are very artistically, but they also sold the kit for the table or hired it out. And these are biscuits and others which have been made from 18th century moulds. So there are wafers, and then there's even little mottos there. Can you see?
Oh, yes.
They're like the love heart things that were still there.
Oh, how amazing.
You know? And then up here, you can't see too clearly because...
Oh, there's the pineapple.
We've got the pineapple, of course, orange. In, these are top glasses for putting on top of a salver like
top
that.
Top glasses?
Yeah, and they often used to put an orange in them. It was even carved in little figures. And
oh, how beautiful.
Know. So, it's a culture that has sort of vanished. They also made wax flowers as well as... These are sugar ones.
Those are sugar flowers?
They're sugar flowers, yeah.
Oh, now, my goodness.
If you come around the other side... So that's the kind of... That's what you might see if you looked in the window. Basically... It's not a window display, it's an insight into...
Inside the workshop, as it were.
Basically, you've got a French... There were lots of French, Swiss, Italian confectioners who had businesses in London, you know. Negri was one of them, and but a lot of them were French as well. So, basically, this is a French book, which has got this illustration of a table centrepiece made of sugar. And can you see the parterre?
Yes.
Well, if you look at the parterre on there...
It is the
there
same.
They are. So the idea is that he's got a copy of the book and he's thrown the illustrations onto his worktop and he's arranging
the little figures.
And then you've got this is a palace of Circe. And then these little modelling tools are the ones that they use for making flowers. And you see that makes a leaf. And a lot of the flowers around there were made using these tools. Up there you can see a flower, a petal cutter, and then you can make little fringes with that one. And then, if you remember, there's a basket. There's a mold we have as well, which isn't in there, which makes that. And then you flex it around the form, the little rococo basket, fill it with flowers. So, for instance, on the top of the cakes, if you remember, you've got
the crowns. Yes.
There's
how to make them.
It's a crown mold from about 1780. That these are not Fitzwilliam, they all belong to me. So there's, and up there is a flower frame to show how they dried out the flowers. In the Negri account, it lists the looking glass and the bronze frames. So the business was called the Pot and Pineapple. So on this side here, we're hoping fruits, pomegranate, very much linked to a wonderful painting, you know, which I've seen.
Oh, how fantastic.
So on there, we've decided to put an enlargement of this bill from Negri, which lists all of the things that have inspired these two. And also, of course, on it is this wonderful emblem of the pot and the pineapple. So it links the pineapple into there. And this sorbetier comes from the shop. It comes from Gunter's. He married Elizabeth Gunter in 1758. It was a Cornish girl. And they had some nephews. He went back to Turin, actually, and died there. And his wife continued the business. And then she got old and she left it to two of her nephews, who were called James, and the business continued right through to the 1950s. Actually. Elizabeth David used to go there. Her mother, she was telling me, she said, Gunter's ices, the best in London. Mm. So the pineapple leads into the culture of confectionery.
At the time, the other set pieces of swan and peacock pie, amongst other amazing displays, were still being assembled. This is a must-see for anyone interested in the history of food, both feasting and fasting. And it opens on Tuesday with a late night opening on Thursday.
Yes, definitely a must-see exhibition, and one that's getting a lot of attention nationally as well. Jay Rayner, for example, mentioned it in his column in The Observer last Sunday.
But now let's find out about what a couple of Cambridge independents have in store this Christmas. First, Chocolat Chocolat in St Andrew Street, where owner Isabel is talking with Sue Bailey.
We've already got quite a lot of our Christmas products that we get from Belgium. Certain things we won't make ourselves, because especially the big shapes, bigger shapes, but we will be making our own chocolate bars and our sheet chocolate, which is what everyone will come in for. And I will start to make the most popular is our Christmas cake flavour on milk chocolate, which I will make only 6 weeks before, because it has 7 ingredients on it and they're all fresh, so it is made to be bought and eaten within 2 months. The second one I'm doing is a lovely dark chocolate brownie with a spiced brownie this year, and a white one we call our nutcracker, which is pistachio, cranberries and a little bit of sparkle on white chocolate. If you want a little piece of chocolate, whether you're diabetic, whether you don't want to have much sugar, then it's always worth having a little piece of really lovely, good quality chocolate, which leaves the cocoa taste in your mouth and the little bits of cocoa in your mouth, rather than have something where you can buy lots of it, but there isn't much cocoa in it. Because if the longer the cocoa stays in your mouth, the less you will eat.
And also go for good quality chocolates, which are the ones that you stock.
Well, good quality chocolates have the less ingredients a chocolate has, the better quality it will be.
And now over to Newnham, to Meadows in Eltersley Avenue, where I spoke with Susanna Watson.
Right, Susanna, here we are in Meadows, and you're getting your Christmas produce in. Well, can you tell us what sort of things you'll have?
Well, we're filling up the shelves, Alan. We've got lots of special Christmassy things coming in from our existing suppliers, and then we're working with one or two new suppliers as well. It's always an exciting time of year, because for us, the unpacking of boxes happens a few weeks ahead of everybody else. So for me, it feels like Christmas is coming already. So we'll be doing a selection of hampers, and we'll have some that we've chosen ourselves, and then the option for people to come and choose what they'd like to give in our very nice hamper boxes. And then other than that, fruit and veg wise the clementines are arriving. We've got some lovely walnuts from France. It always makes me feel like Christmas is arriving. In the kitchen here, Amesh is already busy making Florentines and mini Christmas cakes. She'll be starting the macaroons soon. They're available to order now, but we make them fresher, closer to the time. And all sorts of things are being discussed, like stollen and gingerbread and all the really delicious Christmassy things. We have some really nice things on our chocolate shelves as well. Pump Street always do their famous chocolate Santa, which is always popular, and they've got some chocolate covered orange peel as well, which is always a real treat.
Is it? No, that's not something I've had. What, is that not slightly bitter?
No, so it's candied orange, right. So it's a lovely sweet slice of candied orange dipped in really delicious dark chocolate, so definitely a treat. Yes, yeah. And then, you know, it's always a nice opportunity to try new things. So all of our regular stock will be here. In terms of new products, we have just been in contact with Hallan Mon Salt in Wales, in Anglesey in Wales. So they're sending us a delivery. And I also have contact with a lovely company in Hampshire called Summerdown Mint. And they're going to be sending us some of their really famous peppermint chocolates.
What are these chocolate thins in the exactly. sort of style of After Eight?
Yeah, well, they do. Yeah, so they do a cream, peppermint cream. They do a peppermint crisp, which is really delicious, kind of chips of peppermint in the chocolate. And the flavour of it is absolutely delightful. It's really specialist variety of peppermint that they grow. It's a nice story, actually. A descendant of the Coleman's mustard family started this project, and they brought back the variety of peppermint from the States, and they're now growing about 100 acres of it in Hampshire. So it's a nice project to be involved with. Cheese-wise, it's a nice time to bring back some of our favourites. So from France, we'll have the Vacherin Mont d'Or, which we've spoken about before, but it's a lovely seasonal cheese, and Christmas is a perfect time to enjoy it. We also have some Beaufort from the French Alps, which is one that I tend to just get at Christmas time because there's not a huge demand for it all year round, but people do ask me for it at Christmas time. And then in terms of our British cheeses, I'm trying to zone in on the cheeses that come from East Anglia a little bit more, so, and from the east of England. So we've got Baron Bigod in place of a Brie. We've got lovely Norfolk Tawny, which is made near Holt. And we will have, just from further north, some Stitchelton, which is the unpasteurised Stilton cheese made on the Welbeck estate in Derbyshire. And then we'll also have the Sparkenhoe Red Leicester, which is the only farmhouse Red Leicester that's been made.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Christmas this year is on a Wednesday, I think.
Yes, that's right.
And you're normally open Wednesday till Saturday. So yes. In that Christmas week, are you?
We'll be open for extra time, of course. So we open on the Sundays leading up to Christmas, so Sunday 15th and Sunday 22nd, and then we'll also be open on Monday 23rd. Both Amesha and I are travelling overseas on the 24th, so we won't be here on Tuesday 24th. But there'll be plenty of time to pick up all the cheeses and baked things that people need. So we'll be here for that.
Yeah, and you were saying before about having a tasting?
Yes, so next Saturday, the 30th of November, we're having our festive food tasting day. So all day from when we open at 9, we'll just be opening up all the jars and packs and things that you can't normally try before you buy in the shop. We'll be open to try not every single thing, but the festive things will be all there to taste.
What a great idea. What a great idea. And on this, the book, which I know that you've had in stock for a little while, The Cheesemonger's History of the British Isles, you said that you've got a special event to do with that as well.
Yes, so both the book is available to buy as a Christmas gift, and also next year in February, 7th of February, we're really excited that Ned Palmer, the author of the book, is going to come and do a tutored tasting with us. And you know, for those who don't want to buy things as Christmas presents and would rather have experiences, tickets for that tasting will be available to book as a lovely gift, either for yourself or for someone else.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks,
Susanna.
Very much.
Thank you. Yes, well, that all sounds very good, doesn't it? And the tasting day, unfortunately, I think I'm going to be away that day. Also, another piece of news that Susanna imparted to me is she will have a stall at the Winter Fair, which is on the 7th of December, as we've already said, and her stall will be in the Gwydir Street car park, and it's well worth going to.
And there's that familiar music signalling time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yes, well, people have been doing quite a lot of tweeting today. Let's start with Sarah Lavelle from Quadrille. She's tweeted that three of their recent cookbooks, including Leaf by Catherine Phipps, which we featured here on Flavour, are in the Financial Times Best Books of 2019 Food and Drink section. Roberto's Deli have tweeted to remind us that they are on Cambridge Market, opposite Marks and Spencer's, every day except Friday, with some really nice produce. I bought some chorizo from there recently. It was jolly good. Azahar Food Van is at Ely Market with his Spanish food until 3 o'clock today. And don't forget, he has a stall also on the Sunday Market in Cambridge. Pizzo Mondo are at Calverley's Brewery in Hooper Street right now. And Bushel Box Farm, Station Road Willingham has all sorts of treats in its weekend cafe, including chocolate amaretti macaroons and upside-down apple maple syrup cake, which just sounds divine. John West, he of the Art of Meat in Arbury, has tweeted. He doesn't do a lot of tweeting, so this must be important. He's got some beef Jersey crossed with limousine, and it's hand-raised, pasture-fed beef from the Peacock Farm in Landbeach. So I should think that would be really worth going for. And that's the end of today's tweets, Matt.
Lovely.
Cambridge 105 Radio, as I'm sure you've all noticed, is broadcasting mostly from the Grafton Centre today. And we've got a bit of news about their food offer. It's unusual for food malls to have independence because generally the people who own the food malls want their tenants to take very long leases, and also they worry about anybody who might go broke and therefore the place will be empty for a while all of that's sorted out.
Yeah.
So generally it's the big names that get tenancy at food malls, but the Grafton Centre has several independents, so I think that's very good. There's Amelie's, I can never say this.
Amelie Flancouche.
That's the one, yeah. Which we've featured on Flavour before. And Signorelli, which has got a new place there, with an awful lot of staff, actually. So there's two independents, and we featured that one recently as well. But it doesn't stop there. There's Duck Truck, which is apparently big in London. There's Gale's Bakery, which is on the entrance to the Grafton Centre. There's also a Cambridge chocolatier that supports autism, you know, employs people who have autism. And last year, they made a quarter of a million chocolates, which is rather a lot, I think.
Imagine even
counting them. There are some new food outlets opening soon too. There's a burger place, independent burger place, and also a presumably meaty place called Skewer. So plenty of good alternatives to that Costa that lurks on the ground floor.
Yeah.
So good for them, that's what I say.
Yeah, and it's also important to point out that Signorelli's Deli, what they offer in their section in the Grafton Centre is different to what they offer in their Burley Street shop.
So, you know, that's very good.
Yeah. That's an important point to mention.
Okay, so we're well impressed on
that. Shall we go on to the news now?
Okay, let's start with jobs, shall we?
Okay.
Pizza Express in Waterbeach needs a pizza chef. The closing date is the 26th of November, and you apply via the Pizza Express website. The Ivy in Trinity Street needs a sous chef. Closing date is the 29th of November. Apply via the Ivy website. And the Trinity, which is next door to the Ivy in Trinity Street, needs a chef de partie. Closing date is the 4th of December. And for that one, you can pop in with your CV or email it to info@trinitycambridge.co.uk.
And good luck if you're applying for any of those jobs. Please say that you heard about it on Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. And if you want to advertise a vacancy in this slot, you can send an email to sales@cambridge105.co.uk.
Right, here's a non-local news story, though we can all take advantage of it if we've got enough cash. The Northern Brewer, Northern Monk, which is based in Leeds, has brewed the country's most expensive beer. It's an 11% ABV Imperial Stout, and it was brewed at the top of Ben Nevis. And yes, they hauled all the brewing equipment up to the top of the mountain. And on the way, they foraged various ingredients to use in the brew, including blueberries. Now, only 50 bottles have been brewed, and each one will cost you £1,000. All the proceeds will be going to a foundation that funds projects in the north of England.
Now, Maurizio in Mill Road has begun its Christmas menu, and very enticing it looks too. There's some welcome drinks and bites, a choice of starters which includes salmon and potato flan and crispy pancetta with garlic and tomato. Mains include wild boar, an Italian fish pie or butternut squash parmigiani. The cost is a very reasonable £28, and you can book with an advance payment on 07957 735 844, or you can email them info@maurizio.com.
Some events coming up from Cambridge Wine Merchants. There's a Fizz and Fortified night on the 30th November, which will include various types of sparkling wine as well as port, sherries and Madeira. It's £30. That includes a cheese and meat platter, but other dietary requirements can be met if you contact them in advance. It's at 3 p.m. and it's at the Cambridge University Centre next to the Mill Pub in Granter Place.
Cambridge wine merchants also have a Chateau Neuf de Pape and the Valley Beyond tasting on the 17th of December. Now, this is with chairman and co-founder Brett Turner. There is a cheese and meat platter and 9 wines to taste. It's a seated tutorial masterclass, and the wines include Gigondas, Vaquera, Rasto and Carignan, and there will be some wines on offer to buy as well. That too is at the Cambridge University Centre. It begins at 7 p.m. and tickets for both can be obtained from the Cambridge Wine Merchants website.
I think we're running out of time, Matt.
Oh, okay.
So let's just finish. A quick reminder, 7th of December, Millroad Winter Fair. No flavour that day because Cambridge 105 Radio will be broadcasting live from the fair all afternoon.
Okay, so shall we have a quick look at what's coming up later today?
Right. Coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio later today, live from the Grafton until 5 o'clock, the football results from 5 till 6, Chris Brown's Soul and Dance 6 till 8, and 8 till 9, Sweet Revenge, and 9 till 11, Paul Christofora's Rock of Ages with Professor Lester Lloyd Reason looking back at his career.
Good.
What could be better?
And we'll be back on the 21st, is it?
Yes, I've written the 21st of February, but it is December. So until then...
Goodbye. Bye.